Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Tioko Tsotse. Tioko, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing great, things, and how are you, Nick, sir? Good
I'm
afternoon,
good.
Gabriel, sir, and everyone watching.
I'm pretty good, full of beans for a Monday. And, of course, we also have Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you doing, sir?
I'm jolly. It's a jolly Monday. Had a delightful weekend. Got to go to the Johnny Clegg tribute concert, which was this sort of amazing gathering of South African bands from the 80s to like new acts I'd never seen before, and some band that had to fly in from the UK because they were exiled in the 80s and haven't come back since, but they came back, and we all sang in Zulu and English and hoped that we still knew how to sing the words and what they meant. Anyway, it was a wonderful thing.
Ah, excellent. Wonderful, wonderful. Anyway, we have a sponsor today, and our sponsor is Bitvice. So Bitcoin is a complete hedge against the global debasement of money, inflation, and government overreach. Bitvice is a South African-first, Bitcoin-only self-custody solution that helps individuals and entities buy and hold Bitcoin for the long term. Bitvice believes that everyone should hold their own Bitcoin and trust no one else. Recently, there have been a plethora of crypto custodians going bankrupt, taking their clients' Bitcoin with them. This is why Bitvice never holds your Bitcoin. They can send it immediately to your own Bitcoin wallet where you hold the keys, not your coins. Simply sign up to Bitvice, link your bank account securely, and buy Bitcoin in seconds. Visit bitvice.io and begin your journey in buying and securing the scarcest asset that mankind has ever created. So we thank them very much for sponsoring the show today. Anyway, let's get into it. We had over just, I think it was on Friday, comments from President Ramaphosa, which I actually forgot about, and I suspect it's because they were so disheartening that my mind erased them from my memory rather than retain them. But luckily, Gabriel was here to remind me that the president had made this claim. And that is that he suggested that perhaps we should have an ESCOM 2. So while speaking at the South African Communist Party's elective conference, which was ongoing last week, President Ramaphosa said that the country has had just one electricity provider. He said, Eskom has been operating as a monopoly for over 100 years, and having one company taking up the role of providing energy to the entire country poses a great risk. If Eskom fails, its failure becomes a peculiar failure for the entire country. And so he suggested that perhaps the country follow a proposal made by Mining and Energy Minister Gwede Mantashe, which proposes that a second electricity providing state utility be created to compete with Eskom that has a separate system. And the inspiration for this is China, where it has a number of state-owned power providers who compete amongst themselves, ensuring that the price of electricity is greatly reduced. Gabriel, Eskom 2, so good, we need a second one. How do you feel?
Yo, dude, I feel like there's a certain kind of teenager who think... This seems like the guy whose marriage is going wrong. So he's like, I'll just get a mistress. That's going to make it better. I'll get a second wife. You know what's going to make the problems with the first wife much easier? A whole other wife. All of the polygamists that I know say that that is not a formula for success. You only go for a second wife or a third wife if the first one is very happy with the situation and everything is going smoothly. So I think it's a stunning example of something that's actually very common in South Africa, which is not to fix broken things, but just to restart. In the public sector, maybe most devastatingly, we had the Scorpions, which was a special investigative body that was supposed to be taking out corrupt politicians. And look, it flagged prima facie evidence against Jacob Zuma, brought the evidence to take down Shabir Sheikh. There were all kinds of other people who were in the crosshairs, and we sort of canceled that and then built a new Scorpions called the Hawks. And that seemed like just not a great move. The CBD of Johannesburg was going strong, and then during the transition, there were some terrible problems, some rent strikes, some bad things between hijacked buildings, all kinds of stuff. Instead of fixing that, we built a new CBD in Sandton, then a new CBD in Midrand. You know, we just keep running away from our problems in a way. And I think that in Eskom's case, it's running away by running right back into the heart of the problem. There really is a sort of supplementary solution, which is to allow the private sector to come in. There are experienced international players that have been called into situations like this. In developing markets where government has proven itself unable to generate enough power for GDP growth to keep going, there's like a handful of these international consortiums that compete with each other and have a proven track record. Instead of bringing any of them in, there's this sort of terror that someone else might make a profit while the country improves, while more jobs get added, while more young men find dignity in work and turn away from crime and abusive relationships. You know, there's a very cut your nose to spite your face refusal to allow all that good stuff to happen, because it also would mean that someone makes a profit, maybe a foreigner or an Umlungu or something that's not acceptable to the agenda. So I think it's a very silly idea at a time that we can't afford it. We're running a campaign to reduce load shedding by maximizing value for money by getting an exemption from BEE procurement at Eskom. There already was an exemption earlier this year. We want to bring that back on a much longer basis. We've got the precedent. We've got the laws on our side. We just need the voices. So, you know, I always remind people, please sign up. Help add the pressure to help Eskom get a real solution to its problems. We can't run away from Eskom. We need to solve those problems. So I really do encourage people to sign up. But Nick, I want to say one last thing, which is just that the president said this to the SACP, and behind him, the banner said 100 years of unbroken struggle. So I just want to remind you what the communists were doing in 1922. They were inspiring the Rand Revolt, a bloody mess, a really awful bloody mess, in which one of the slogans was, "Workers of the world unite for a white South Africa." I'm not connecting their history to that. They're connecting their history to that. 100 years of unbroken struggle. Do the SACP, there's not a bad idea in this country's history where you won't find the SACP right next to it, dude. From apartheid to the worst aspects of the new dispensation, the SACP has been behind it. In one fashion or another, by a different name, the Communist Party of South Africa, it was called. But it's really commies. Yes, it's a problem. Communism is a problem.
Right, and of course, they also suggest we go to prescribed assets. The opening of their conference last week, which we did a show on. Just a personal anecdote to give you an idea of how mad some of my family history is. I have a great grandfather who was an experienced artillery man, and the moment he heard about the Rand Revolt breaking out, he went to rejoin the army so that he could shell the strikers. But, Diego, what do you make of this idea of Eskom 2.0?
I think it's nonsense. But knowing ANC politics, how I've come to know them throughout the years, I think it's a strategy they want to use to generate money over the years so they can sustain this thing of theirs that is the ANC. But honestly speaking, I am 100% with Gabriel. What needs to happen quite clearly at this point is that you need to end the monopoly of Eskom and allow the private sector to compete in the market, produce electricity. You might even find that the private sector could produce electricity at a much less amount, and people could actually benefit from that. But more than anything, jobs will be created and stuff of that nature. But I do think, yeah, generally, I think like we've discussed before, the ANC is out of ideas. And the ANC of today, really, every strategy that they tend to come up with, it's a strategy around how to steal money, how to do money. If we were to come up with a second Eskom, then we get to be busy with the development project. We get to give out tenders and stuff. They get to bring money into the organization and stuff of that nature. But really, it's nonsensical, but not shocking at all, because this thing is supported by President Ramaphosa, who's a so-called businessman, but throughout his life really hasn't invented a single thing. So it's really people who are out of ideas, but more than anything, people who are greedy and want to find a way of making money. And this is a perfect way for them to suck out money from our state coffers, sure, I think.
You know, this whole idea is so mad. I keep thinking to myself that someone must have said to the ANC, if ESCOM 1 was so great, how come there's no ESCOM 2? Which immediately must have set their minds to work. Gabriel, any final thoughts on this before we move on?
Yeah, I think that John Endres, the CEO of the IRR, has been talking about state capture 2.0 for quite a while, for years. And I think connecting the dots between what Diego is saying and what you're saying, Nick, we as South Africans think Eskom is a failure because we as South Africans have to sit with this problem of not enough electricity to keep the lights on. But there are people who have made huge fortunes out of Eskom 1.0. State Capture 1.0 was a great success to a tiny minority of kleptocratic connected cronies. And those oaks have got every reason to try and go for State Capture 2.0. I thought that we'd mainstream the idea of State Capture 2.0 as a thing to warn people about sooner than later, because it seems so obvious as a concern and as something that's already happening. But in a way, the ANC is just trying to help us out. I mean, it is advertising State Capture 2.0. Vote us in again in 2024, and that's just more of what you're going to get.
Definitely. All right. Let us move on to our second story. This came out, I believe, on Sunday. And that is that senior ANC Deputy Secretary General Jesse Duarte passed away at the age of 68 after an 8-month battle with cancer. At the time, she was the acting Secretary General of the ANC, as I believe Issa Kashule still holds the position, even though he's been suspended. And she'd been somewhere in the secretariat since 2012, and she was re-elected in 2017. She had quite an interesting reputation as being a sort of fiery character who was not afraid to say things rather bluntly. At least that's what her colleagues and allies say of her. Gwede Mantashe said that she wasn't afraid to speak bluntly and make her mind known. She had a long history being born in Coronationville, Johannesburg in the 1950s. She grew up in Westbury. She went on to kind of get involved in the ANC at that period. She was also became famous because she was a personal assistant to Walter Sisulu and Nelson Mandela at various points. She was not very popular with many in the media as she was, she had a reputation of being a bit of a bully. She was famous for shouting at journalists and telling them that they shouldn't think so highly of themselves. Mantashe said she was a straightforward person. If it's black, it's black. What you see is what you get. She talks straight, and that's what many of you in the media couldn't accept. She talked straight and said things as she saw them. During her funeral on Sunday, because she was buried according to Islamic rites, which means you have to be buried before I think the sun goes down. I apologize if that's not 100% correct, but I believe that that's the way. So her funeral was very short after her death, and Issa Makashule was in attendance, and he used the opportunity to give a speech about how she had told him so many great secrets about the ANC, and that these may now come out that she has passed away. Gabriel, what are your thoughts on Jesse Duarte?
My thoughts are with her family, and those who are close to her, because they have something to grieve. She was clearly dynamic and interesting and I think quite good in a sense to those who were close to her. I had an interaction with her, which I think is worth recalling, and it's not so kind, but so it goes. Issue was invited to send someone to a panel discussion as sort of representing civil society. And there was Jesse Duarte representing the ANC, Siviwe Gwarube for the DA, Herman Mashaba for Action SA, Justice Malala as preeminent journalist and I was there too. JJ Tabane hosting. I mean, it was quite a fun event for an hour to be in a room with those guys, especially during lockdown.
Yeah, that sounds fiery.
Dude, and it
and
was.
Jesse Duarte.
And Jesse Duarte. I mean, it really did get quite spicy. And the thing is, nobody agreed with anybody else about anything excepting for everybody agreed about one thing, which is that the ANC must go. and that there's no sugarcoating it. And it was so interesting because I was trying to come with like cold, sober facts, and Justice Malala was sort of taking quite an interesting philosophical approach, and Herman Mashaba was telling jokes. He really had a stunning joke, which still sits with me. He said, the ANC is so bad. You know, if your car is breaking down and then you go to the manufacturer and they say, we don't even make parts for this car anymore. You can't replace the part. He said, the ANC said, look at the youth league. You look at the next generation. These parts that are breaking at the top, there's nothing to replace those parts with. You must just throw, you must scrap that car and you must get a new car. Dude, and the cameraman, someone had to come out at an advertising break and like tell the cameraman to like tone it, like don't giggle while you're holding the camera because it's affecting the quality of the show. They had to cut to a different angle. Dude, the staff was like, and not just with the sharp chirps, also just with some of the bullet points of facts and data that speak to the tremendous failures. And this is in the build up to the municipal election, or just afterwards, a kind of post-mortem. Anyway, Jesse Duarte was so frustrated afterwards that she climbed down from the stage and went and called for the producer and chewed him out and said, I am never coming on ENCA again. You guys treated me with disrespect. You've got no sense of respect for your elders or for politics. You're just making politics toxic with this critical attitude. You're being negative about South Africa. And how are we going to go forward unless you, you know, show some discipline? And I felt for her in that moment in the sense that I had just seen her spend an hour get humiliated. But nothing was more humiliating than what she herself said. She just had to lie through her teeth to try and make up anything that sounded good about the ANC's municipal performance or its government performance or the economic performance or the jobs numbers. There just wasn't, you know, other than, I suppose, the few true things she could say is that the ANC was important in the struggle. So she had, like, good points to make about apartheid and the ANC's struggle against that. But, like, since then, not a hell of a lot to say. And I think it was an ungraceful way to, you know, in a sense, I don't think she has been back to ENCA. And now she never will be. And I don't know, to those, maybe the swan song is just, there was the story about an 84-year-old guy who quit the ANC, handed in his party card 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago. You know, it's not too late to get divorced and try and find something, you know, if you're that energetic. I mean, she was so energetic. Like, maybe put your shoulder to a different wheel if the only alternative is to put yourself in the kind of situation that she found herself in. I thought it was very unfortunate.
Tiego, your thoughts?
Well, condolences to her family, obviously. But I do think that we must be honest that Jess is one of those people who have gotten us to where we are as a country. She was part and parcel of the ANC that got us to where we are. So although at a human level, I do feel that for her, but just at a logical level, I hope that wherever she is, that there's an entrance somewhere where people must be held accountable for all the things they did on earth wrong. And that she doesn't go through that access until such a time that she has accounted for everything. But nonetheless, condolences to her family. And yeah, that's all I have to say really around her.
All right, let's move on to our next topic. This is it's one of those sort of, it was written, I think, as a kind of a feel-good story. This was in Times Live today. There's a story about a Durban logistics company. They have a warehouse which stored a lot of fuel and petrol, and famously there was a photograph taken of a petrol tanker being stolen by looters from this warehouse. The warehouse itself and a lot of the infrastructure was damaged during the July riots last year, the whole thing was burned down. It cost almost just short of 9 million rand to repair this project, and involved in the reconstruction is probably some people who were involved in the looting. the MD of the group, of the responsible for this, speaking to the media, said the rebuilding process was not only about rebuilding the physical infrastructure, it was also about mending relations between communities. As a proudly South African business, we are cognizant that there is more that unites us as South Africans than that which divides us. That's why when we started rebuilding, we ensured people from the nearby settlement were given first priority. We did this with the knowledge that some of those people may have been involved in the looting spree of July 2021. It is our belief that some people who took part in the looting were driven by poverty and hopelessness that it brings. It is therefore crucial these communities were brought on board through the rebuilding process so that they felt they were part of a bigger cause. It is our duty as business to help in alleviating the job crisis the country faces. We are playing our part and implore our counterparts to do the same. Tiego, what do you think of this?
Well, I think Samuel's group is much better at business than I am an individual, right? I think if I was in charge of the company, I would have probably taken my money and went to invest elsewhere. I think for me, while yes, it's true that there is more that unites us than what divides us, when you are in an area whereby people really just want to focus on what divides us and keep on destroying things. If I was in their case, I wouldn't give into that. But I think it's a good thing that they have kind hearts and everything. But the reality of the matter is that not all businesses are going to be like Samuel's group. So really, South Africans really need to change their way of thinking as soon as possible, because not everyone is going to be as forgiving as Samuel's group, and we might end up with companies leaving the country, more companies leaving the country, more jobs being lost and stuff of that nature. So I do think at some point South Africans must be taught that lesson, that there are consequences to everything that we do. And I of course don't think that companies like this ones assist with that, but I guess it's their own choice. I mean, it's their money that they are spending and stuff of that nature. But I wouldn't be against someone who says that they are disinvesting, because it doesn't make any logical sense to continue investing in such an environment. I would fully be in support of such a person. And yeah, I hope that South Africans as time goes will change their mindset and stop seeing businesses as enemies. Stop seeing looting as a solution to poverty and stuff of that nature. South Africans must wake up and realize that, at some point must wake up and realize that this country belongs to all of us combined. And if it's gonna work, then we must come together, put our heads together and really drive solutions together in a respectful manner, respect businesses, respect the next individual and stuff of that nature. So in summary, I think it's good what they've done, but if it was my company, I wouldn't have done the same thing, and I wouldn't put a wrong on someone who decides to do the opposite of what Samuel's group did. Yeah.
So, Gabriel, I have in my mind the words of people like Thomas Sowell, who often talk about unintended consequences. And one gets a somewhat sinking feeling that there might be some unintended consequences in this decision to be, as Diego says, so open-hearted about repairing the damage that was done during the riots.
Yeah, it's very nice. And, you know, who knows? The particular facts on the ground could be very different. But I had the experience in Mashadadorp, for example, where I went to go cover an incident where it was a race incident. The incident itself, there was camera footage of some racial slurs and people beating each other up. But then this ended up inspiring a mob to go and burn down the police station and the library and basically the only infrastructure in the township. And while some of the embers were still hot, I was going around that township to the people selling guineas and so on, asking, like, what does the community feel about this? And I was surprised at how little resentment there was. I said, why aren't you guys more angry? Like, this is your stuff. This is our stuff, but it's especially yours because it's in your neighborhood that's been burnt down. And they said, well, to us, it doesn't affect things one way or another, as like old goggles. But those angry young men, they are going to get jobs out of this, because when they come and do the rebuild, they're going to have to come and take locals here, because that is the way that the system operates. And the same ones who burnt it down are going to be the ones who get those jobs. And I thought, hell's teeth, because most of the anger had come from EFF guys that had come from far away, and I'd been to the police station where they were so drunk at night that they couldn't continue to negotiate with the holding of the hostages who'd been accused of beating up an old white guy. Anyway, it was a very long, complicated story years ago. But it, you know, I was like, this is the EFF swooping in and making anger. And they were like, well, no, that is part of it. But on the other hand, there's also this hope that you can burn something down and then get a job to rebuild it. And I think that it's worth remembering an older economics lesson. Frederick Bastiat was a French economist in the 19th century. He's one of the early greats. You know, after Adam Smith, you've got Bastiat and Balthus and Marx and all of these guys trying to figure it out. And Bastiat has this very simple story in like peasant rural France where he says, you know, he has a grocer and someone breaks the window of his shop. And now he's going to hire someone to come and make a new window. And he sees that now he's got a bit more space. So he's going to make a new sign. So he's going to hire someone to paint the sign. He's going to pay for someone to sweep the pavement where the glass was. All of these people are getting jobs. Isn't it good for the economy to break windows? But it's like some people think like that because they don't believe in value add, because they believe that how money works is he's got money in his pockets. And to make the economy work, it's like you have to pop the bubble and that money will leak out and redistribute. And it's just a matter of redistribution. So when you break his business, he starts redistributing money. They don't see that you actually, if you work intelligently, the day can end with more in the world than it started with. An extra shoe or an extra cheap piece of lettuce or carrot or whatever it is that those customers are coming to the grocery store for. And that they're not going to get a discount anymore because now that money has to go into paying for the new stuff. So value add versus value grab, I think it's a deep, deep problem in South Africa. And this is what TFO is saying, like people need to change their mentality. Unfortunately, the minority that have a value grab philosophy are intellectually supported by the Communist Party, are effectively politically endorsed by the ANC. I mean, if you're championing expropriation without compensation, you're just sending a huge signal to guys that the way to get ahead is to take other people's stuff. The South Africa's academy, a lot of its media, there's just too much to amplify. Every society is going to have selfish people who don't believe in building, breakers, burners, angry people, of course. And with this much unemployment, of course. But there's so many other parts of society that just add to it and exaggerate its influence and bring everyone else down. And I don't think that we're going forward unless that reverses. The balance of forces has to tilt against that. And people have to see that if you don't burn the factory in the first place, then you can have a second factory, you know. Never mind Eskom 2.0. What about like another factory that can make more canned goods to export through Africa? We have an amazing manufacturing food sector. We've got amazing industry potential in KZN, connected with a port in a strategically important position, mainlined with the highway to the financial hub of the continent. If the rail system worked, wouldn't it be amazing? If the ports worked, wouldn't it be amazing? But anyway, you know, we know all these problems. But they are physical problems. I think the mental problem of just not believing in work is expressed by people who think, yeah, you burn it down and then you can pull more money. You steal, you loot, then you burn it, then you pull more money to rebuild it. It's not a sustainable growth model.
Yeah, no, my father once made a similar point. He was having a sort of thoughtful rant, and he said, you know, the great struggle in South Africa is between the builders and the breakers. This country has very many builders, but they are kept prisoner by so many things that happen in the country and its politics and its policy and its elites who are very keen on the breakers' side at the moment and have been for a while. Diego, any final thoughts before we close up the episode?
Final thought would be that really, really, really the mentality has to change. I mean, I went to Northern Academy High School, which is a Kiro high school. At Northern Academy, you'd find people littering all around. You ask, why are you littering? They'll tell you, hey, we're creating jobs. I went to Rhodes University. Same similar thing. Here in Polokwane, I find a lot of people throwing litter on the ground. You ask why? People say that they're creating jobs. So there's really... I think the South African problem is way beyond the ANC. There's a mental shift that needs to happen in the minds of the majority of South Africans. And I hope that, yeah, institutions such as the South African Institute of Race Relations will get it right and be able to drive that mental change. But even beyond the ANC and everything, there's just something wrong in our society and how people generally think. And I think it needs to change if we are to move forward as a country, sure.
Very wise words, sir. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. Please, if you liked this podcast, leave us good reviews on the podcast apps. Like the video if you're watching us on YouTube. Please subscribe to our channel. And, yeah, share it around with all of your friends and family. Put it in that family WhatsApp group to annoy all of your non-political friends and relatives, because I think that we produce stuff that's worth watching. So thank you very much. I hope you all have a wonderful day, and we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.